Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with John Horgan about the lies we tell others and the lies we tell ourselves.
It becomes simpler if you suppress the truth effectively and you actually believe your own lies.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Christopher Beha tells us about the state of animal rights in American literature.
We allow our emotional connections to certain creatures blind us to the fact that there are lots of other animals that are capable of suffering and feeling pain, and we don't care about that.
And Gregory Coles has bestseller news. There are the lies we tell others and then the lies we tell ourselves. There's an important new book. It's called The Folly of Fools, The Logic of Deceit and Self-Deception in Human Life by Robert Trivers. It's reviewed for us by John Horgan, who's here to talk about it. Welcome, John.
Nice to be here.
All right. So Trivers is kind of an important guy. Tell us about him and what he's saying in this book.
Well, he's one of the most important evolutionary theorists of the 20th century, and he's not very well known because he's never written a popular book before this one. His biggest idea is called reciprocal altruism, and it's basically an explanation of why humans are nice to each other when they happen to be nice to each other. So,
what is the explanation?
So it's an explanation not of why we're nice to blood relatives, because gene theory explains that fairly simply. The question is why the Good Samaritan is nice to the person he finds in the road who's been beaten up and is completely unrelated to him. Trivers says that over evolutionary time, there are benefits for being compassionate toward others, for helping others. And so natural selection embedded this impulse toward generosity and altruism in us. It's an emotional impulse. It's not something that we rationally calculate. But the reason that we have this impulse is because in the aggregate, and again, over many, many generations, this benefits individuals.
Okay, so now we're talking about not such altruistic behavior, lying.
Right.
And what's his argument there?
Well, apparently Trivers has been interested in lying for a long time. He had a few papers going back to the 70s on lying. And so he's tried to pull all his thoughts together into this book. And by the time I was done with reading this book, it made me introspect quite a bit. I began to wonder when we're ever honest with each other. Trivers, first of all, talks about how ubiquitous deceit is in nature. So you've got creatures playing possum. You've got various insects using camouflage and various subterfuges to try to avoid predators and so forth. Humans start lying. I mean, one of the most disturbing examples that Trivers mentions, and is obvious to me as a parent, is fake crying by infants. Infants very quickly learn that if they start crying, that they get a big reaction out of people around them. And so you get false crying by infants. And that leads eventually to a line of all sorts in families, in business relations, all the way up to the lies that nation states tell themselves.
And why do people get so good at lying? How are they able to pull it off?
Well, so Trivers is trying to come up with a Darwinian explanation for why we lie and also why we're so good at deceiving ourselves. We lie, obviously, because we want to manipulate others in pursuit of our own ends. And he thinks that we lie to ourselves, which we do quite a bit, because then we're better liars. He says that if you have truth and falsehood in your mind at the same time, that it's a pretty complex process. And so it becomes simpler if you suppress the truth effectively and you actually believe your own lies. Also, you get benefits from lying if you convince yourself that you're a better person, you're stronger, and so forth. It's a kind of placebo effect. It makes you more self-confident and it becomes self-fulfilling.
So how, John, does he know all this? Is this based on research? Is this just a brilliant man who's thought a lot about human behavior?
A lot of the book is speculation. He cites lots of studies of humans and non-human animals. One of the things that makes the book peculiar in a way, but also compelling to me, is that Trivers is ruthless at examining his own personal life. As a scientist who's competing for a position with colleagues, as a husband, he's been married twice, as a father, he looks at all these episodes in his own life and comes up with examples where he has lied to others and only realized it after the fact. The book is actually a weird combination, but it worked for me, of a scholarly treatise and a confessional memoir.
And do you think this book will make him better known to the broader public than he has been so far?
I think it will. Trivers is not a slick prose stylist the way that some of the people who have used his work are. So Richard Dawkins, among others, has relied quite a bit on Trivers' theories, reciprocal altruism and some other work. The great evolutionary biologist Edward Wilson also is a very popular writer. Steven Pinker, who's a popularizer of evolutionary psychology, they have all relied on the work of Trivers. He is not as skillful a writer as they are, but he has this kind of blunt honesty that I found very appealing in this book. I hope it gives him the audience that he really deserves.
Well, a bluntly honest book about a man's own lies. How could you not want to read that?
Yeah, right. That's how I look at it.
Thanks a lot, John.
Thank you.
That's John Horgan, who reviews The Folly of Fools, The Logic of Deceit and Self-Deception in Human Life by Robert Trivers in this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So, Julie, here we are, holiday time, and we worry about poor Scholastic, which is the great, powerful publisher of children's books. And much though many may envy them, their peak seemed to come with the extraordinary Harry Potter series. Have they found any way to move forward, to find a new exciting set of books to publish?
They're trying. They're waving their magic wand, and they just announced that they're producing another big blockbuster franchise, as they did with The 39 Clues, which was a big multimedia series that they first released in 2008. Now they've said that they're releasing another one, which will be called The Infinity Ring. And this is a 7-book series on time travel.
Who's the author?
There are many authors. The first author is James Dashner, who writes for children. He's well known for his Maze Runner trilogy, and he's going to write the first and the last book of the 7, and then they'll use a bunch of other children's book authors for the books in the middle.
Julie, crazy as this sounds, the Harry Potter books and the extraordinary J.K. Rowling actually came out of, and I'm embarrassed to say this, previous era when not everybody in creation was online doing social media or whatever. Is this new series somehow adjusting to the change in social media?
It is, and it's really a reflection of where children's publishing is going. When The 39 Clues was released, it was released as, you know, not only of a long series of paper books, but it also had a gaming component. And Scholastic has pumped up that element of Infinity Ring even more. They'll have 7 paper books, ebooks in this series, but they'll also have an online game component that will be able to be played on smartphones, on tablets. So potentially, a child could read this entire series and play all the games, which integrate together, only on an iPad and never actually pick up a paper book.
And Julie, when will we be seeing the first of this new series?
The first of the series will come out sometime next year, and then they'll roll out every 2, 3, 4 months. And they're not saying exactly when the last one will come out, but you know, it'll be a kind of a typical Scholastic thing. There will be tons of marketing, tons of advertising, and you know, all of the Scholastic power will go along with it.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
We are living in the age of animal rights, and there are more and more animals whose rights some of us are concerned about. There are a number of new books on the subject, and we asked an excellent essayist, Christopher Beha, to review them for us, which he's done in this week's book review, and I'm delighted that Chris is here to join us. Hey, Chris.
Hi, Sam. Thanks
okay, so let's start off with this argument that Peter Singer made. He's the one who kind of made the world aware that we should treat animals, humans should treat animals as almost like equal species to ourselves. Then you say that a kind of double standard has entered, that we treat some animals better than others. What
sure.
do you mean by that?
Singer introduced this term speciesism, and he was a utilitarian, and his argument roughly was that we allow our emotional connections to certain creatures, other human beings and some animals, blind us to the fact that there are lots of other animals that are capable of suffering and feeling pain, and we don't care about that. So cows are every bit as sentient as dogs, and we don't care about the suffering that a cow goes through before it winds up as a steak on our plate, even if we care very much about our pets and their suffering.
Right, right. My family, we have a dog who's 14 years old, and she's a member of the family, and we take her to the doctor regularly, and I feed her medicine pills in the morning, but I might eat a hamburger somewhere and not think twice about it.
Right. So Singer thinks that this doesn't make a lot of sense. And because Singer was sort of the founder of the modern animal rights movement, it's been a core value of the movement that these emotional connections to pets in particular are blinding us to our obligations to a lot of other animals.
So let's look at some of the books you discussed. There's one called Loving Animals Toward a New Animal Advocacy. And it is by Kathy Rudy. And you say this is a substantial book. What's her argument?
Yeah. So Rudy is a women's study and queer theory professor at Duke. She is quite a sophisticated thinker on these issues. But she's also someone who herself has strong emotional relationships with animals. And her argument is that an experience like you're describing with your family and your dog can actually be incredibly powerful when it comes to thinking about animals in general, and that the animal rights movement made a mistake, basically dating back to Singer, in removing these emotional connections from their arguments.
So does she then think it's possible for us to expand our emotional universes and begin to think about other animals that way, or that it's just good enough that we care about the ones we do?
No, she thinks that you should use your relationship to, say, your dog as a way to think about pigs or chickens or cows or other animals that are, you know, closer to dogs than maybe they are to humans in their ability to feel pain or to feel pleasure.
Now, there's tremendous human sort of empathy or romance with the dolphin. And there's also a book called The Dolphin in the Mirror, Exploring Dolphins' Minds and Saving Dolphin Lives. It is by Diana Reese. And what does she contribute to this ongoing discussion?
So she is a marine biologist who has studied dolphins throughout her career. What's interesting is that, like Rudy, she has particularly strong emotional relationships to animals. So she notes in the book that when she was growing up, she felt closer to her dog than she did to her brother. And so her study of these animals, which is, you know, scientific and tries in a lot of ways to be objective, is very much informed by her emotional attachments to those animals.
Okay, now we have another animal, the bear, which is not necessarily in sight unless you're John Irving. Particularly warm feelings. The book is called The Bear, History of a Fallen King. Provocative subtitle by a French historian, Michel Pastoureau. And what does he have to tell us?
So Pastoureau talks about the mythology of the bear, essentially, which in early medieval times and dating back to pre-Christian times was considered in Europe in particular the king of the beasts, basically, in the way that we think of, say, lions now. They were considered very majestic, very powerful. And in fact, dating back to pagan times, they were very godlike. So the god Artemis, that root R is from the word for bear, as indeed King Arthur, that's the same R.
And has this changed over time?
And his argument, I mean, it obviously has changed over time in that we don't think of the bear as the king of the beasts anymore. His argument is that it was particularly the rise of Christianity in Europe that made that happen. Early Christian church transformed a lot of the feasts that were centered around bear worship into saints' days, and they exterminated a lot of bears also, and in general made efforts to make bears either sort of fearsome, diabolic creatures or figures of fun, as we now have in the modern, the idea of the bear on a leash at the circus sort of thing.
So Pastro is a historian. He's doing an entirely different kind of research from someone like
Right. Reese. But the way that they all connect up, I think, is that Rudy and Reese, both one an ethicist and one a biologist, are very engaged in storytelling. They want to put these animals within the framework of narratives that have emotional connection. And Pastoreau is doing a similar thing. He is talking about the way that the stories we tell about animals affect our treatment of them. Basically, the cruelty that was inflicted on bears in the early Christian era was very bound up with the stories that early Christian Europe decided to tell about bears.
And Chris, finally, we have a book by quite a fine British essayist, Jenny Diskey. Her book is called What I Don't Know About Animals. So she must be coming at this from a different
perspective. She absolutely is. Diskey describes her background as post-domestic, which is to say that she didn't grow up with animals in the house other than pets. She didn't grow up on a farm with pigs and chickens and whatnot, which is also my situation and I think probably a lot of readers' situation. And she does not feel this natural emotional connection to animals that Rudy does or that Reese does, but she's really feels a great deal of wonder about the strangeness of animals, actually, and she still feels compelled to treat them ethically. And in her argument is the one that I was most convinced by, because it's basically in keeping with my own feelings about animals, which is that I often don't think they're very much like humans. I don't enter into emotional relationships with them the way that I do with humans. And yet it seems pretty clear to me, and this would go back to Singer's argument, that they are capable of suffering and capable of feeling pleasure, and that those capabilities create some obligations for us.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you.
That's Christopher Beja, who this week reviews several books on animals in our Nonfiction Chronicle. Gregory Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg, what's new on the list this week?
Hey, Sam. Well, the only new book on the adult hardcover list is Tom Clancy's latest, Locked On, which enters at number 2. But over on the ebook list, Christopher Hitchens is selling well, with God Is Not Great making its debut at number 10, and the essay collection, arguably, debuting at number 17. And on the kids list, the Denver Broncos quarterback Tim Tebow's autobiography, Through My Eyes, has just been released in a children's edition that enters the chapter list at number 8.
All right, now I'm confused. Tebow's book was an adult book, wasn't it? So yeah. How do they redo it for the kids list?
Well, this is actually increasingly popular in books. I know Fast Food Nation, that big success by Eric Schlosser and Marley and Me, were also released as kids' editions after they became huge successes on the adult side of things. So, right, Tebow has spent 15 weeks so far on the adult list. It's still on there this week, I think, at number 6. But to turn it into a kids' book, I actually called Zondervan, the Christian publisher who brought it out as a kids' book, and asked that very question: how do you repackage this for kids? Some of it really is just the packaging. The type is bigger. They include a poster, a Q&A about Tebow's life. Then they've also put more emphasis on his childhood by trimming some of the more recent material from the book. The kids' edition has just 18 chapters instead of 21. And they go through making the language more kid-friendly throughout. I asked the marketing director at Zondervan if she's a football fan, and she said, right now, I'll tell you, I'm really rooting for the Broncos.
I bet she is. Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.